Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
This is a time of war, global peril, Ukraine. These are not normal times. Bring down the price you are charging at the pump to reflect the cost you are paying for the product. Do it now. Do it today. Your customers, the American people, they need relief now.
That is Joe Biden, the Democrat president of the United States, who is now calling for the kind of tax relief that Republicans have been arguing for some time now. And welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to the best conversation in talk journalism, and one that you are welcome to join anytime you like at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. You know that. We've done that for 25 years. We're going to keep doing it for another 25 more. I know that's disturbing to liberals out there. So be it. If you want to send me an email, they all come right to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can vote in our Twitter poll. I'll get to that just a little bit later. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network as well, providing honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for more than 22 years. Now, Joe Biden knows how to spread the blame when he has a problem that threatens his political party's very existence. Joe blames Putin. Joe blames the war in Ukraine. He's begged for oil from foreign dictators from Venezuela to Saudi Arabia. He blames the oil companies. In fact, in that soundbite you heard at the top, bring the price down to reflect the price that you produce the product at. Boy, I wish they'd do that with cell phones and smartphones. Because, you know, when you make those smartphones for a couple of $100, you then sell them for a whole lot more than that here in the United States. But this is what Joe has done. He blames Republicans. He puts the blame everywhere but on his own shoulders. Let me point out, since Joe Biden took office, he has now issued 39 new regulations and executive orders that restricted the American energy business and American energy independence. And that is the biggest driver of prices going up for gasoline and diesel. In fact, they began going up last summer when Joe Biden couldn't blame Ukraine or Putin because Ukraine and Putin hadn't happened yet. So Joe Biden did three things today just in the last several hours. He attacked the oil companies for what he calls profiteering. I know that's a popular thought. I think it's baloney. He announced just a three-month suspension of the federal gas tax that is 18.3 cents a gallon. Listen to this.
By suspending the 18-cent gas tax, federal gas tax, for the next 90 days, we can bring down the price of gas and give families just a little bit of relief.
Yeah, just a little bit of relief. He forgot to point out that Congress has to actually sign off on that, and Congress is only a few weeks from going away on their summertime vacation. Maybe it's falling off his bicycle that has Joe talking a little bit, just a tiny bit more conservative today, but he's demanding that states also suspend their gasoline taxes. Here it is.
That's why the second action I'm taking is calling on states to either suspend the state gas tax as well or find other ways to deliver some relief. State gas taxes average 30 cents per gallon. Already, some states have acted.
Yeah, now here's what's crazy. Which states have suspended their gas taxes? Well, conservative states like Florida and Georgia have done it. And people will say, well, Lars, New York, Maryland, and Connecticut, those are liberal states headed by blue state elected officials. That's right. New York, Maryland, and Connecticut have suspended their gas taxes, but only for tiny periods of time. If you thought 90 days from Joe was a big suspension, in one case, Connecticut, they're suspending their gas tax. They've already done it, and it's already over for 30 days. And in liberal California, Republicans in California demanded suspension of the state gas tax, while Democrats announced they would continue to investigate why the prices are so high. They want to figure it out first. Then Joe Biden wrote a letter to the oil companies, and the president threatened them and said, I'll use my emergency authority, that's what he called it, if the companies do not comply with his demand to increase production. So the same president who signed those 39 executive orders and regulatory changes to curb the production of energy is now demanding that the same companies he's regulating increase their energy production. And thank God, Chevron CEO wrote back, and he kind of gave it to the president with both barrels. He says his company is producing more oil today than at any point in American history. And then he took aim at Biden specifically. Quote, your administration has largely sought to criticize and it sometimes vilify our industry. These actions are not beneficial to meeting the challenges we face and are not what the American people deserve. President Biden's response was snarky and not on point. Listen to the question and Joe's answer.
A question on the Chevron CEO's complaint today. He said that your administration has largely criticized the oil and gas industry and at times vilified it, and that the administration would need to take a change in approach in order to make progress on reducing energy prices and to increase supply. Do you have a reaction to that, sir?
It's mildly sensitive. I didn't know they'd get their feelings hurt that quickly.
This is a bunch of garbage. The solution to the crisis from Chevron: thoughtful action, a willingness to work together, and not political rhetoric. Chevron's chair responded by saying, all you've done is try to criticize us. Biden even suggested that the oil companies are not pumping oil that's ready to go. Listen to this nonsense.
We need more refining capacity. This idea that they don't have oil to drill and to bring up is simply not true. This piece of the Republicans talking about Biden shut down fields, wrong. 9,000 of them.
Now, hold on. You know the 9,000 he's referring to? That's not an oil field. It's a lease on federal land that in theory gives you permission to drill for oil and maybe find it and maybe not. Except you have to have a whole bunch of other federal permits that are being slow walked by the Biden administration. You got the piece of land. Why don't you build a house? We have to have a permit. How about wire the house? Got to have a permit. In the case of oil drilling, it's just the same. The fact that you have a lease on a piece of land, or 9,000 of them, as Joe says, it doesn't actually work because you have to have all those other federal permissions to do it. And then Joe says, hey, oil companies, get busy making more refining. Listen to that.
We ought to be able to work something out whereby they're able to increase refining capacity and still not give up on transitioning to renewable energy.
Yeah, the problem with that is that refining capacity, there hasn't been a new refinery built in decades. And why? Because the current administration has told the oil companies, we're going to put you out of business in about a decade. So you want to go to these companies and say, spend billions of dollars on refineries that will only pay for themselves over decades, but we're going to put you out of business in 10 years? Joe Biden is apparently not smart enough to understand that he's created the conditions that tell the oil companies, don't spend money on refineries. Don't expand your current refineries. Don't, for God's sake, don't build any new ones, because when you pour those billions in, you will never get the money out. And if any oil company was stupid enough to do that, they'd face a shareholder lawsuit against them for that kind of action. In any case, this is what Joe's solution to his problem is. Coming up, some Republicans on Capitol Hill plan to sell out citizen rights for a new law on guns that won't make any difference at all when it comes to violent crime. I'll give you my take on that in just a moment on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right, you know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Brought to you by Handyman Maintenance Remodeling. You can find them at hmrservices.net. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
So the United States Senate has a brand new gun law for Americans. You probably heard that. And for the life of me, I can't see how, having read through the details of this law, it changes anything when it comes to mass shootings or other violent crime. But the Democrats, who are desperate for anything successful in an election year filled with Joe Biden's failures, they've talked some Republicans into selling out, and shame on them. More background checks for gun buyers over 18 but under 21. Nothing that would have changed the killings in Uvalde, Tulsa, or Buffalo. It increases penalties for straw purchases. That's when somebody without a criminal record buys a gun for a criminal with a record. It's already against the law. Sadly, those laws don't get enforced very often. So more penalties for crimes that are not prosecuted, that's worse than a joke. Girlfriends and boyfriends convicted of domestic violence will be banned from buying a gun. That is assuming that Congress gets around to deciding, and this seriously is part of the bill, what a serious dating relationship consists of, how much time you have to spend with a person, did you sleep with them yet or not, and what is not a serious dating relationship. What could possibly go wrong with Congress defining those kinds of things? It pushes more states to adopt red flag laws. Those are the ones that allow the government to seize your guns without due process. Remember that part in the Constitution where they said no man or woman's life, liberty, or property may be taken without due process? Well, they leave that part of it out, and that's why the red flag laws are unconstitutional on their face. And the federal government does not enforce the laws it already has. There is a law that prohibits a convicted criminal from even trying to buy a gun, attempting to buy the gun itself, and signing the paperwork to attempt to buy that gun is a crime in and of itself. It's already a felony. When the General Accounting Office checked, it found in 1 year, 2017, the most recent for which numbers are available, 112,000 prohibited persons attempted to buy guns, signed the paperwork, could have been prosecuted. Out of 112,000 people in a single year who committed that crime, 12 of them, not 1,200, not 12,000, 12 out of 112,000 actually did it, actually got prosecuted. That is a rate of 1 in 10,000. Now, does it suggest to you that if you want people to obey the law, and you say, but we very rarely prosecute people, and even the ones that we catch red-handed, we don't prosecute, who's going to comply with a law like that? If you knew you could go up and accumulate all the parking tickets you want and never, ever have to pay them, or you'd only pay them if you were the 1 in 10,000 chosen for that, you'd just go ahead and stack up the parking tickets. 14 Republicans in the U.S. Senate plan to gut your rights. But the Democrats need a victory this year, and for some strange reason, some Republicans on Capitol Hill want to give it to them, even as we're right on the cusp of having the control of the House and Senate go to the Republicans instead of the Democrats, and even if it steals the rights of citizens. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Naysayers always go to the head of the line, and you can vote in our Twitter poll as well. Today's poll question, you know, we always write up a new one out of the news of the day to make sure it's fresh. Today, should public schools lock up their sports fields so that even outside of school hours, the public cannot use them? I know it sounds crazy to ask it, but it's actually happening here in the Pacific Northwest. Should public schools lock up their sports fields? This is public property, so the public is not allowed to use them. Now, I'd love to have you vote on that. The Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, other things I want to mention to you, and then we'll get to the grill. First of all, great email. Pearl wrote in, Lars, yesterday you were talking about gas prices and vacations. We go camping every year for 2 weeks with several members of our extended family. We camp about 5 hours away from home. I budget about $1,500 for the trip. Well, we have decided we're not going this year, as just the gas will use up the budget. We, of course, have funds we could pull from savings or make adjustments like not bringing the boat, but I refuse to spend our savings that way, especially with not knowing what's coming up next from our corrupt government. In my humble opinion, I don't think we're the only family making these decisions. Thanks for all you do. Signed, Pearl Hetwer. Well, I'll tell you something, Pearl. I guarantee you, you're not the only family doing that. And our question of the day is posed by Dwayne Basham. He says, Lars, U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley sent out an email to his constituents that contained lies. I had to respond. He wrote back to Merkley, please get the facts straight. One woman, a veteran, was killed by the Capitol Police January 6th when she crawled through a window in the Capitol building. No other lives were lost that day. Why do you tell these falsehoods? And I think that's a great question. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Rogue Conveyors. Go Rogue.
Now, the Daily Grill is going to go to an already planned hike in the minimum wage. This happens to be in Oregon. In Oregon, the minimum wage, July 1, minimum wage workers will go to $13.50 an hour. In the Portland area, $14.75. Both are increases of 75 cents an hour. I want you to ask yourself, does this help the worker? And if you say, yeah, their paycheck will get bigger. That's assuming the business has the money to pay that extra money and doesn't just cut their hours, which an awful lot of businesses are going to have to do. And what is that increase going to do to businesses that are still struggling to come back from the pandemic? I would imagine it's not going to do them any favors. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. I try to respond to all of them. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small, collision or paint repairs. Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Greg Waddy writes in, Lars, when Reagan signed an order deregulating price controls on energy companies, especially on gas, allowing the energy companies to set gas prices and compete, the experts said prices would go up. Instead, they went down by two-thirds and stayed that way for about two decades. An executive order restoring oil production, even though it would take a while to actually go into effect, would drop oil prices immediately as commodities are based on speculation. Trump and his rally on Saturday should make it clear to people that the energy policy is not just cheap gas, but a deterrent to other nations who seek to harm us, like Ukraine. We actually had peace in the Middle East when we were energy independent because we no longer depended on other places for energy. And we didn't have to sacrifice lives in war, signed Greg. Well, Greg, you might have noticed that today I started with that soundbite from Joe Biden saying, we're in a time of war. And if you ask yourself, as I did, hold on, did the United States declare war in Ukraine or declare war on Russia? And I guess the only straight answer to that is, well, not yet, but give Joe a chance. He screwed up Afghanistan. He screwed up Ukraine. He'll probably screw up Taiwan. So are we going to be at war soon? Time will tell. Don't ever underestimate Joe's ability to screw or to blank things up, as Bob Gates once said. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network, and always glad to welcome back my friend Aaron Mesh, the news editor at Willamette Week, because we were so inspired by Sophie Peel's story, because Aaron is Sophie's editor. I might even suggest some edits, but it's a pretty good story. We made it our Twitter poll today. Should public schools lock up their sports fields so the public can't use them? Kind of a tautology, I think, but it doesn't make sense to me. Aaron, welcome back.
Good to be here.
See, the only issue I'd take, because I hate to beg the question, but when Sophie writes this story at WWeek.com, and I recommend people use it, about the crazy folks at the school district, Hosford Middle School, have said, we're going to put a fence around public property and then lock it up outside of school hours so the public can't get access to public property. I think the first question is, and did you have a handshake deal with the school about using it after hours for public use? The first question is, can they legally do that and take public property and make it off limits to the people who own it?
I think they can. So, excuse me, I'm dealing with a little bit of allergies this morning. My understanding is that there are time, place, manner restrictions you can place on public property, and you can limit which members of the public use it. So a school field theoretically could be restricted only to students, teachers, etc.
I think, let me tell you why I think you're wrong about that. But, you know, again, you and I disagree agreeably. When you talk about time, place, and manner restrictions, the courts always say, and they have to be narrowly tailored to meet a specific need. So if you say, well, we can't let the public just wander through, say, a prison or the back room of the police station because those are secure areas for a specific reason, you have to tailor the restriction to a specific need. So if you say, we want to lock people out during the school day to keep bad people away from the kids, that makes sense. But if you say, and then when the school day is over and the staff has left and the kids have left, we're going to lock up the building for the other 8 to 16 hours of the day and both days of the weekend and all of the summer, that's not exactly narrowly tailored, is it?
It's not. But let's back up for a second, not because I necessarily disagree with you, because I think it's good to lay out the parameters of the story, right?
Yeah.
So here we have Hosford Middle School in the leafy Hosford Abernathy neighborhood. Most people who live around Portland would know it essentially as Division Street. It's an area that's grown a lot in the past 10 years, hundreds of new apartments, dozens of new apartment buildings, a lot less park and green space than there used to be. And for more than a decade, neighbors had an understanding with the school district that after school hours, they could use Hosford Middle School's rather rolling large field to walk their dogs and to run their dogs. And then during the pandemic, that became increasingly important to people living in that neighborhood because there weren't really a lot of other places to go outdoors where you might not breathe on other people and where you can get some exercise. So then about 6 months ago, the district decides to put up a fence around the field. And then they put up gates, and then they lock those gates with bolts. The official reason why they're doing this, they say, is because dog owners have been irresponsible and the dogs have left droppings on the field and dug holes that, and this is sort of my favorite detail, holes that kids have fallen into. It may not be that that's the only reason why the school district is doing this. Private emails suggest that, in fact, the principal is more concerned about homeless and mentally ill people who have taken up residence on the property and are sort of just placing the blame on the dog owners. But so, at any rate, geez. No matter who's to blame, the people who have the dogs want their field back.
Well, and it is their field. They own that property, and it is public property. And as far as blaming, saying it's really the homeless we're worried about, you know, setting up their camps or leaving their dirty needles. But we don't want to say that because that wouldn't be politic to criticize the homeless. So let's criticize some law-abiding, honest local neighbors who pay their taxes, work, pay their own rent, don't live in a tent, and they walk their dogs down there. Let's blame the honest people instead of blaming the social ne'er-do-wells, the antisocial crowd that is the homeless. And they are an antisocial crowd. They're mostly living on the streets because they've worn out their welcome with their entire family and all their friends. And now they want to occupy. If they want to blame the homeless, then they ought to blame the homeless. Why not?
Because this is Portland. We don't blame the homeless.
We blame the law-abiding, well-behaved citizens who might have left some dog poop behind. But if the humans go in and poop on the field, that's okay.
Well, it's also Portland in that those law-abiding citizens have now taken up bolt cutters and are essentially occupying the field.
You know, I'm going to tell you, Aaron, for probably 10 years, I've been arguing but I've been making the case to people that when you begin to break the rules to favor one group instead of another, whatever the group is, at some point, people are going to say, well, if he doesn't need a permit and he doesn't need to do this, then screw you. I don't either, just on principle. I mean, for example, Aaron, I'd like to be able to burn some of my yard debris. But the government at every level, city, county, state, everything else, has all these limits. And I say, hold on. You let all these homeless camps have fires all day long, sometimes fires that have killed people, sometimes fires that do tremendous damage. And you don't go enforce the rules on them, then as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to burning yard debris, pound sand. That and it builds a disrespect, almost an activist or aggressive sense of, screw you, I don't have to get a permit. If they don't need one, I don't need one. This is dangerous to the whole system because most of our system is built on voluntary compliance, isn't it?
Well, I think where we would agree is that I do see a sort of general breakdown of society and a growing kind of civil disobedience that isn't very civil and a belief that the rules aren't enforced equally, and so therefore the rules are essentially bogus. I think I see that across the political spectrum. I see it in Portland. I see it across America. And it is very discouraging.
Well, it's discouraging, but if it's being driven, not just by people's disregard for the law, but it's being driven by the very people in responsible positions, like school superintendents, city councils, county commissions, saying, we're going to enforce the rules on some, not on others. There is no equality under the law as guaranteed by the Constitution. And so you're just going to have to suck it up and take it, citizens. Pay your taxes, shut up, and send your money. Then a lot of citizens like me are going to say, no, yeah, guess what? We're not going to play that game. If you've decided you're going to exempt certain people from the rules, then we're all exempt from the rules, aren't we? And is that unreasonable a position to take?
What I find funny about this personally is that I know who a lot of the people in this neighborhood are who own these dogs and who want to run their dogs in this field, and they are some of the most progressive, liberal, lefty Portlanders. And the fact that their greatest public advocate is Lars Larson is just going to make them so miserable. And that makes me happy on some weird level.
Do you know what, Aaron? Who was it? Rizzo was the police commissioner in Philadelphia who decades and decades ago said, you know what a conservative is? A conservative is a liberal who just got mugged last night. Now, I think this fits that situation.
Well, this is a story about dogs, so it would be a liberal who just got pugged.
Yeah, and they just got pugged. And as far as I'm concerned, I think you're going to drive a lot of progressive types to conservatism because they're going to say, hold on. If this is what progressivism is, that we have rules for all, but some animals in progressive Portland or progressive Seattle, some animals are more equal than others, like on Animal Farm, I think they're going to decide they don't like playing that game anymore. And good for them. Welcome to the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, I also would offer them my party.
Which is?
Cynicism.
It's not the 420 party, but cynicism, that's okay. I don't want to be a cynic, but I do want to say the best way to get rid of a bad law is thoroughly enforce it. And I guess the best way to get rid of good laws is to not enforce them at all. That's Aaron Mash, the news editor. You can find Sophie Peel's story at WWeek.com. Coming up, a big anniversary I forgot to mention yesterday. I'll make amends for that coming up next, and your phone calls and emails on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network for the past 22-plus years. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. As you know, naysayers go to the head of the line. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll, should public schools lock up their sports fields so the public cannot use those public properties? I would say no to that. You can vote any way you like. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I was remiss. I actually put this on my list of things to talk about yesterday. Yesterday was a huge anniversary. 1942, so 80 years ago, the only time that a military base in the contiguous United States was attacked by the Axis powers, that would have been Germany and Japan. Japan was the one in this case. The only time that a military base in the contiguous United States was attacked by Axis powers during World War II. What happened? Yeah, 80 years ago yesterday, the Imperial Japanese submarine I-25 shelled the U.S. Army's Fort Stevens coastal defenses. It's not far from Astoria. It's actually near Warrenton, Oregon. I've been there. I've seen the little bench that they have that commemorates this. Apparently, the sub commander, Akiji Tagami, had been told to go out and sink enemy shipping off Oregon's coast, Oregon, Washington, California coast. It was manned by a crew of 97. They came into U.S. coastal waters. They were following fishing boats to avoid minefields in the area. He ordered his crew to surface the sub on the mouth of the Columbia. His target was Fort Stevens, which is a fort that's been there since the Civil War. It's not really armed anymore at this point, but it was then. And he opened fire with a 12-millimeter, I think it was 12 mil, no, not 12-inch. He had 14-centimeter guns, which I think is about a 4-inch deck gun. So the fort immediately went into blackout so that they wouldn't spot gun flashes. And the commander, sadly, said, don't, to his men at Fort Stevens, don't fire back. but most of the rounds landed in a baseball field or a swamp, and that was about it. One round did sever several large telephone cables, the only damage the Tagami caused. 17 explosive shells had been fired at the fort. No injuries, no damage. And the Japanese attack on Fort Stevens, they say, along with an attack in the Aleutian Islands, you know, Alaska, the same month helped create the 1942 full-scale West Coast invasion scare. So a piece of history from 80 years ago yesterday. I neglected to mention it yesterday, but now I've done right by that. Let's go to Richard. Hey, Richard, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
So I was talking about Juneteenth. You were talking a lot about it yesterday. I don't know if you ever heard of the circular 3591?
No, I have not.
Okay, it was a circular put out by Franklin Delano Roosevelt on December 12th, 1941, which was, as you know, 5 days after Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
He went to his commanding officers in the military and says, what can Japan hold against America? And they said, debt peonage. Do you know what debt peonage is?
I think it's when you're in debt and you go to debtor's prison, which is forbidden by the Constitution. It means that if you owe somebody money, you effectively become their slave till you work it off. Am I right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's what the Democrat Party, after the Civil War, did. They put in black codes and black laws, crazy kind of laws, like it's not allowed. You're not allowed to talk too loudly in front of a white woman, and you can't sell cotton after dark. And after dark is code word for being black. You know, so, and then they put these people in prison. They'd make them sign a contract that says you are held in a cage, held on this property, chained up, and if you escape, they can come capture you and bring you back, and you can do this until you pay this debt off. And none of the people back then, none of the freemen back then knew.
Okay, but I'm not, what does all that have, so because we're going to run out of time at some point, Richard, you've spent a long time getting here, what does this have to do with Juneteenth?
I think the Democrats want to say Juneteenth as the day of the end of slavery instead of announcing that, no, we kept slavery going until 1941 and we had to have Franklin Delano Roosevelt end it.
Well, except that FDR was a bigot himself, and I've detailed that. And secondly, if you want to say were black people treated equitably, most of the inequities weren't corrected in many ways on employment and school and everything else until the 1960s, except in some places they were corrected, in other places, as you point out, they were not. So you could make the argument that it continued well past FDR, who was himself a major league bigot.
Yeah, well, if you read that that circular 3591, it actually states in there that this debt peonage and stuff is no longer going to be. It was basically an announcement to all the prosecutors out there that we're no longer going to be prosecuting debt peonage.
And you're saying that's when slavery actually ended. Well, it's an interesting theory. Richard, thank you very much. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Washington State forbids concealed carry on school grounds. Oregon schools are starting to do the same. Does that actually make your kids safer or put them at greater risk? We're going to discuss that coming up next on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. But let me introduce Kevin Starrett of Oregon Firearms Federation this way, Kevin, if you don't mind. 2 days from now, we're going to mark 1 month having passed since the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, in which 19 school children were murdered and two teachers were murdered. And now, because of testimony yesterday in Texas, where they're looking into the abject failure, as it's being caused by the Department of Public Safety, of police in that situation, I want to tell you what we found out yesterday afternoon. One of the teachers, Eva Mirlis, who died in that shooting 1 month ago in 2 days, on the 24th of May, she called her husband on the phone, and she said, "I've been shot, and I am dying." Her husband is a cop. He armed himself and he tried to get to her. When he got to the school, he was detained, he was disarmed, and he was put on the sidelines, and the rest we know what happened. I think it's relevant to what Kevin and I are going to talk about. Kevin is with OFF. I'm a big supporter of Oregon Firearms Federation. Kevin, you've alerted people that now we have a number of school districts that have already acted based on the law passed by the legislature earlier this year that said that Oregon schools can begin to forbid concealed carry even by those who have a permit. Scappoose schools are going to vote on this, I think, in about 5 days. They're planning to vote on this. And the question I put to my audience is, does this make your kids safer or does it put them at greater risk? Welcome back to the program, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Lars. You know, I think the first thing we have to note is that we wouldn't even be discussing this if it weren't for the complete sellout of the Oregon Republicans who let this demented policy go forward. But true. Right now in Texas, at the hearings you're talking about, they're not even discussing the failures of the police. They're talking about instituting more controls against people like you and I.
That's right. And I guess I've made the case that I think it measurably makes schools at greater risk when you tell all the bad guys, everybody at this school has been disarmed. Every teacher, every administrator, the custodian, and all of the parents who are coming to pick up or drop off their kids. Because you've pointed out, if Scappoose schools, and I had the same problem you did. I tried to get a hold of one of the board members. You call the school district and say, I'd like to reach out to one of the board members. Can I get an email or a business phone number? And they said, no, you can't. And I said, well, I can file a public records request. They said, yes, you can. Go ahead. We have 5 days to respond, which is actually not true. They're not even giving out the names. And if these people are not cowards, if you're going to serve in a public office, there should be a way to contact you, whether you're a member of the Senate or the House of Representatives. There's even a way to leave a message for Joe Biden if you're so inclined. But to have a school board that you can't reach out to by any means possible and
you can't even identify them. We don't even know who they are.
No, because you go to the board and all they say is here's an email. And if you send the email, it goes into a general delivery box for the entire board. So here are people serving in a position of great responsibility. They're going to vote on something of great consequence and they're secret and you don't know how to get a hold of them at all.
No, it's lunacy, and it's such a dangerous policy. And has there ever been a time where it was more clearly illuminated how demented this policy is? The fact is the best intentions of the cops, which clearly did not exist in this case, would be no substitute for having somebody who's already there. It just makes no sense that a school would look at this situation where there was an abject failure on the part of the existing policy and say, not only are we going to continue that policy, but we're going to expand it, and we're going to tell parents and family members, you can't even come and pick your kid up if you're responsibly armed. You can't go to a school event. You can't meet with a teacher. You can't go to a football game. And if something's happening, if your child is, if there's any kind of danger, you're not allowed to in any way participate in protecting them. And nobody else is except the law enforcement that have been kicked out of the public schools in Portland.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Kevin, people have said, well, why don't we arm teachers? I said, we could. I would let them be armed if I were superintendent. I might set down some criteria, say you got to have a permit required by state law. Might be nice to maybe take a couple of hours of instruction and maybe have a discussion about the kind of ammunition you load in that gun and procedures, you know, that you might want to know if you want to be an armed staff member. I don't think those are unreasonable, but we have states like Texas and Missouri that have armed their teachers, and they put a sign out front that says, if you're coming here, if you're coming here to do harm, some of our staff are armed. And here we have Oregon schools going the opposite direction.
We're not even talking about arming teachers. That should be up to them. And there are a lot of teachers who, frankly, I wouldn't want to be armed. But the fact is, it's not a matter of arming anyone. It's a matter of not disarming people who've taken on the responsibility of being protectors. And so and it's not just teachers. There's plenty of people who work in schools who are competent and capable. And had somebody been in one of those schools when this was happening, it was at least would have been a chance. When in this case, these kids are getting gunned down for an hour while cops sat outside and argued about what they were going to do next and didn't even try the door. Now, I don't want to paint all cops like this because we know that isn't true, but it just points to the fact that you can't assume that they're going to be the ones who are going to come and fix things and then stop the people who are actually trying to help. And in the case of Oregon, once again, thanks to the great leadership of Christine Drazen, now on a district by district basis, it's being forbidden, not even not promoted, it's actually being prohibited. And what does that say to the parents of these kids, that the teachers and the staff, who we say are great heroes, we're going to say, well, we can't trust them or anyone in the school with a firearm, but we say, but you can have first aid, you can deal with fire extinguishers, you can do all that. But somehow these great heroes become immediate idiots when they're given the opportunity to have the means to protect the kids under their care.
And Kevin, I've often been described as being too pro-law enforcement. I am, unless they break the rules. And yet in the last two big school shootings in American history, you know, a decade apart, but you had Parkland in Florida, you've had Uvalde now recently. And what happened? In Parkland, there were cops who stood outside, one of them who cowered outside from Broward's cowards, who didn't do what he, and he was the school resource officer. And then you've got Uvalde, where, as you point out, the cops stood in the hallway and said, we're waiting for a key to the door. And now suddenly you've got members of the legislature saying, did you even try the door? It wasn't locked. And they know for a fact it wasn't locked. And the cops stood outside saying, we're waiting for the master key. And we've got our gear, we've got our shields, we've got guns. We got one guy inside who's armed. And as the Texas Director of Public Safety said, the cops were armed, the kids were not.
Well, and now the bosses there who made these horrible calls are saying, we didn't go in because he had a rifle and we had pistols. And you and I both know enough about firearms to know that was immaterial under those circumstances. That it was the point of having police there is they've understood that there is no time to discuss these things. And like I said, I don't want to assume or paint all cops with this broad brush, but it does point to the fact that you cannot make the assumption that they're going to solve the problem. The only person who could deal with it is somebody who's there. And in this case, we've made, and it's certainly in Oregon, we're making sure that to whatever extent possible, people will be prohibited from having the means to protect these children. And I think it's disgraceful. And I think it's time for people to start looking at their school boards if they can identify them and find out who they are.
Well, Kevin,
and demand that they do something about this.
Kevin, I got to wrap this, but I'm going to tell you, I don't want to call those school board members cowards, but if they're hiding behind anonymity, I can't get their names, I can't get their email addresses, I can't get a phone number. If any one of them wants to speak and speak to this issue as to why they will deliberately disarm SCAPU schools, I'll give them all the time they need to explain it. That's Kevin Sterrett from the Oregon Firearms Federation, back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. If you want to join the best conversation and talk journalism, it's right here. And there are a number of ways to do that. If you want to dial in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go to the head of the line, and I'll go to calls here in just a moment, at 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. They don't go to anybody but me. And our Twitter poll today, should public schools lock up their sports fields so the public is not able to use them? Now, I think that question kind of answers itself, but there are some school districts that have decided, yes, we are public schools. Yes, we're paid for by the taxpayers. And yes, all that land is owned by the taxpayers, but we're going to lock it up so that it cannot be used outside of school hours. And then they blame dog walkers, honest, law-abiding citizens who live in the community, not the homeless and their hypodermic needles, which may be the real reason. Should public schools lock up their sports fields so the public can't use them? I'd say no. You can vote any way you like, at Lars Larson Show or at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to your calls now. First to Armin, who's calling in from King County, Washington. Armin, I notice you call it King County. You don't live inside the city of Seattle, the liberal environs of Seattle?
Oh, gosh, Lars. I live on Vashon Island, which is maybe even more liberal than than Seattle. But anyway, the screener asked me where I was calling from, and I said,
sure.
King County. Anyway, about the school board members, I don't understand how that isn't public information when, if nothing else, you could go back to the most recent election for school board members, and in the state of Washington, at least, we have the voters pamphlet, and each person
can find that
their website and their phone number and their email.
You can find that, but the latest voters pamphlet tells you who is running. What I want is I want every public agency. In fact, if I were running the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, I would say every single public agency, everybody who draws a paycheck here, their name, their title, and their contact info. That doesn't have to be their home phone. I understand people have a right to their personal privacy outside their job. But there should be a way to, in this day and age, I would put up their name. I would put up their office phone number. I would put up their office email. Now, do you think that's an unreasonable thing to say that if you draw a public paycheck, the public should have a right to reach out to you, no matter what level of government you're in, from Jay Inslee or Kate Brown on down to the lowest ranking person at any agency?
As usual, I completely agree with you. I'm just saying that for the moment, if nothing else, there should be that method of finding those people's names. Now, I live on Vashon Island. We have a school board. I'm pretty sure it's easy enough to find out who those five people are.
Have you tried?
I'm really curious because, Armin, I run into this
all the time, because we reach out to the school districts, because if I'm going to bash an agency or laud an agency for doing something good, I give them a chance to respond. I think that's responsible.
Sure.
You know, that. And so, if I say I'm going to criticize the 4J school district in Eugene, which I did about a week ago, for some crazy policies they have, I reached out to the district, called their official spokesperson, who draws a very nice, close to six figures paycheck to be the spokesperson for the district. And I said, I'd like somebody to come on and answer these questions that have been posed to me by people who are in your district. And they're wondering why you're doing this to their kids. And you get silence. You get dead silence. And what really gets me is when you go to, as I did, I went to the Scappoose Public Schools, you click on school board, they do not provide a list of the names of the people on the board. And while you can find it elsewhere, Armin, as a citizen, as a taxpayer whose taxes support Oregon schools, and I pay on both sides of the river, so I end up supporting or Washington schools and Oregon schools, I should be able to easily find the names of the people who ask to be elected to these positions and make these decisions. I should have their name, their official contact email, and official contact number. Scappoose schools provide nothing of the kind. They give you one email that is for the entire board that may not even be looked at by individual members. They have a full-time staff member who's nothing but a secretary for the school board who may look at all the emails, and I don't know if she, and by the way, she's on vacation right now, so she's unavailable, and she may look at the school board email and decide which ones go to the board members and which ones do not. I don't know. I can't ask because there's nobody available. Superintendent has gone to a conference, which I'm sure we're paying for. The secretary for the school board is gone. Why shouldn't we be able to reach out to those people, and why shouldn't government agencies make it relatively easy for members of the public, not just me, but members of the public, to be able to reach those persons who are making these decisions?
Well, I completely agree with you.
So
now you got me Googling my Vashon School Board website to see if they
there's usually a line that says school board, and then if it says members, click on that and see what kind of contact info it actually gives you. Some districts are better.
In our case, this is a small community. These school board members have written editorials in the local paper, the Island paper. I mean, I think we pretty much, most of us who are tuned in, know who they are. But you may have, I'm just surprised and disappointed to hear what you said about what apparently is all too unfortunately common.
Well, it is.
That,
and you know what's funny about it
is
I see people who write editorials all the time, and you say, wow, they're talking to me. I'd like to talk back. And I always encourage people to do it politely and don't use profanity and don't use personalizations. You fat slob, you know, don't do that stuff. But a lot of times people who are elites in government, and that means you don't have to be governor or president or senator to be an elite, to act like an elite. Well, I run the school board and I vote on a $100 million budget. Good. Will you let your constituents communicate with you? Oh, no, no. I talk to them. They don't talk to me. Seems to be the attitude of some of them. And if they don't want it to be that way, do you think the school board, since they run the whole show, could say, by the way, list our names, list a way to reach all of us, put it on the website so that citizens can at least have a sense that they have. I mean, I can call my plumber. I can call my favorite electrician, David Cohn. I can call all these people, but the people you're handing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in some cases, to do these things, oh, no, they can't be reached by the average hoi polloi. You know, how dare a citizen, a subject, who's expected to shut up, work, pay the taxes, and pay for everything, but you don't get to actually talk to us. That seems to be the attitude of too many of these people.
Okay, I just Googled on my phone while you were talking.
Yeah.
Vashon, SD, as in schooldistrict.org.
Right.
And they list the school board members and the agendas and minutes of meetings and so on. So
do they have any
better here than...
No, maybe,
than
but
places.
Armin, is there any contact information for any of those board members?
There is. It's got their name, position, what position they're in, term. There's a whole chart, phone number.
Is there phone number?
And then it looks
like
email. It's running phone number and email address. Each one has an email address at Vashon. SD as in school district, .org. So
then Vashon Island is doing a much better job than SCAPU schools. And I would challenge any of the board members or the chairman of the board. I'd love to have you come on and talk about the decision you're going to make that affects so many citizens. They're going to make it 5 days from now. I think the public would like to know why you're doing that. And is it good for the kids? Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Now, just a few hours ago, Joe Biden came out and announced, I'm calling for a suspension of the federal gas tax. That's 18.3 cents per gallon. And he's also calling on states to suspend their gas taxes. Now, what he didn't highlight as much is that he's asking the Congress to do this. And the Congress would have to act. Both houses would have to pass it. He'd have to sign it, which is possible, although the Congress is due to go on break in about, I think, 5 days when I look at their calendar. So they're going to go on break, and they don't plan to reconvene until early September. And even then, the suspension that Joe Biden is calling for is 90 days, 3 months of a reduction of 18.3 cents a gallon. Daniel Turner joins me now, the president of Power of the Future. Daniel, welcome back to the program. And what should we make of this move by Biden to say, I want the Congress to suspend the gas tax, but only for 90 days, only if the Congress says yes. And he's asking the same of the states.
Yeah, and this is election year gimmicks, right? This is a desperate administration trying to look like they are in tune with the pain of the American people, that they want to help. You know, one thing that's remarkable about Joe Biden, the president, as opposed to Joe Biden, the candidate, when Joe Biden was a candidate, he was going to take on Putin because he told him he had no soul. And he told that guy, I challenge you to a push-up contest. And he was Joe Bravado, Joe, I'm in charge. And now Joe Biden, with all the power of the free world, is this hapless, weak individual. That's Putin's price hike. It's the Congress that has to fix the tax issue. Joe Biden is showing himself every day to be just absolutely emasculated, looking for someone else to take control, looking for someone else to blame, anyone but him. And it's really remarkable to watch that transformation.
You know, I also noticed when I looked to check, there are a couple of states, Florida and Georgia, that have suspended their state gas tax. There are a few, and those are run by conservatives. The liberal states like New York and Maryland and Connecticut, some of them had suspensions of the gas tax, I kid you not, Daniel, that lasted 30 days. They've already come and gone. So it's like, wow, 30 days of relief from a gas tax. You know, that's really going to change the financial picture for American families who are getting stripped bare by these gas prices pushing towards $6, you know, we're above $5 average. And I'm not, I told people I was kind of ambivalent about it because on one hand, every little bit helps when something is as expensive as gas is right now, but 18 cents a gallon, they figure the average savings for the average American is about $9 over the 90 days. And that's assuming Congress does it before they go on summer break on the 27th of June. So, you know, what's the real solution to this?
Yeah, well, first of all, isn't it amazing that the guy who flies home to Delaware every weekend on Air Force One wants you to be happy with a $9 savings over 90 days, right? Like, thank you, Joe Biden, for saving us. Remember last year they touted their 16-cent reduction in hot dogs, and this year it's $9 less in gas. You know, there's only two things that can bring down prices, just following basic laws of economics. The one, which obviously I advocate for, which is increasing supply, increasing domestic supply. That's more drilling. That's more access to land. That, as well as the signal it will send to the markets, that will fundamentally and consistently bring down prices. We saw that in the previous administration. The other way to bring down prices is to drive down demand. And I think you're seeing prices go down a little bit. We are below $5 for the first time since last week. Prices will go down as the demand dries up. But if demand dries up, what does that mean in the first world? It's not efficiency, right? It's not drying up because of new technology. It's drying up because, hey, look, you don't need to drive to work anymore because you don't have a job. right? You're not spending any money on takeout food because you don't have any spare money. And I think that's the route this administration wants to go. We will see oil back to $70 a barrel, and we will see gas prices nationally at $3, but because we are in an economic depression. And Joe Biden will celebrate that and say, look at what I did. Look at how my policies lowered prices.
Yeah, he will. But Daniel, I got an email from a young lady. I don't know her, but she wrote to me and she said, we go camping every year. That's our summer vacation. We go with extended family. She said, but the money we budgeted, because we like to camp at this one place 5 hours away, which is normally affordable, she said, it'll eat so much of the budget, we're just not going to go this year. So what Joe will have said is, I've lowered the price. How? By lowering demand. And how'd you do that? Did you get everybody driving electric cars? No, I just made everybody stay home on their summer vacation. Well, that's not a win. That's a cost for the citizen saying, yep, you're going to have to constrain your own pleasure driving, your own vacation driving, so that you can help Joe try to win an election this fall that I think he's almost certain to lose, meaning his Congress.
And that's really the direction we're headed in, and that's tragic. We don't need to go in that direction. What we can do is go back to supply, and for Joe Biden to continue to blast these oil companies and continue to excoriate their CEOs. And he was making fun of the CEO of Chevron, but personally by name just today. I just wish the Biden administration, I just wish Joe Biden treated us as nicely as he's going to treat the king of Saudi Arabia, right? Or the Ayatollah in Iran. He has sent emissaries to go talk to him about oil. He has sent emissaries to Maduro in Venezuela. So, you know, why does he have such disdain for the American oil and gas industry? I just wish he would treat me as nicely as he treated those rogue regimes.
Well, I played that soundbite of him saying, I didn't know their feelings get hurt so quickly. He stands there and says, look, they say we can't get the oil because, you know, the leases. He says, you've got 9,000 places ready to go. Well, they're not ready to go. They're leases that then require more federal approval to punch the holes, to find the oil, to push the roads in, and all the rest of that. And apparently the Biden administration has been slow walking all that, and yet he gaslights Americans by saying, why, all these oil companies have got 9,000 fields ready to pump right now, except they're not ready to pump.
If you took one of those leases and said, okay, Lars Larson right now is going to start drilling, you would probably have to come up with, let's just say conservatively, $25 million in capital, right? Between moving personnel and equipment and processing and legal fees, $25 million. At X number of barrels a day, even at $100 a barrel, how long do you need for your investment to finally pay itself off and then make money? And so he's saying, how come they're not producing from these 9,000 leases? Well, you're telling us that within 5 years, you hope we're completely out of business. It's going to take us at least 5 years just to recover our $25 million. And so, sadly, and this has nothing to do with patriotism, this is not a good investment right now. Even at $110 a barrel or wherever we are at this current second, it is not a good investment because you are not going to recuperate your money in time with this administration in charge.
Well, I want to speak. Can you add that to the refining issue? Because he brought it up and said, I want them to expand their refining capability. And I said the same thing to my audience. You want an oil company to either build another refinery, which hasn't been done in decades, or expand their current refinery at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, while you're telling them, and in 5 or 10 years, you're going to be out of business and you'll never get the money back. If Daniel, you're with Power of the Future, but if you were the head of an oil company and you did that, said, let's be patriotic, let's spend a few hundred million that we're never going to get back, you think your stockholders wouldn't have you in court very quickly?
Exactly. Just 2 days ago, the Biden EPA stopped the permitting of a refinery expansion in Louisiana on the Gulf Coast. And of course, the reason why they stopped the expansion is because of climate change. So when we see everything through the lens of climate change, whether it's the EPA or as they are doing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, as they're doing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, when all these agencies have to see everything through the lens of climate change, they are sending very clear market signals. The sad thing about the refining deal is that when we lose refining capability, other places are dominating it or growing in it. China right now is the second largest refiner in the world. They were not a decade ago. They were way behind the Saudis, way behind the Russians, way behind even African nations. But China is now number two. They are the world's largest refiner of jet fuel. what is China going to do to the world economy when they control refining capability? But that's where we're headed. So there's tremendous geopolitical risks on the line right now.
That's Daniel Turner, the president of Power the Future. Daniel, it's always a pleasure. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. And this is the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk every single day. And you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com. For details, send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And during that long summer of riots and in the year after it in 2020, I heard from so many people, and I believe that they were right, that there was a nationwide conspiracy by Antifa and BLM, two domestic terror groups, to carry out these riots. And I heard story after story of people who saw folks flying into Portland, out of Portland, into Seattle, out of Seattle, who were going apparently to these protests. They had signs with them. They were wearing the kind of all-black garb that they call black block, and they would show up and cause trouble in one city and then move on to another. And the problem was, I had people who told me this, and I said, listen, I believe you. The problem is, can I prove it? Well, we've got a bit of proof here. An Indiana man has now been sentenced. This is the toughest sentence for anybody associated with that summer of riots, lest you think that all those riots and the looting and the three dozen murders and all the other bad stuff that came in the summer of riots in 2020, that all of the people, or many, even many of the people, got bad punishment. This is the toughest federal penalty stemming from 100 plus days of protests that began in the summer of 2020, except they weren't protests. They were riots for the most part. An Indiana man sentenced to 10 years in prison for violence at the 2020 riots. Summer and fall of 2020, Malik Muhammad from Indiana traveled to Portland, threw Molotov cocktails at police, smashed the windows of the Oregon Historical Society during the so-called racial justice protests that were, they weren't about racial justice, they were about the election that happened in November of that year. Earlier this year, Malik Muhammad pleaded guilty to 14 felonies, including attempted murder. So attempted murder and 13 other felonies, and he gets 10 years in prison is all? Last month, he pleaded guilty in federal court to two counts of possessing unregistered destructive devices, meaning the Molotov cocktails. A federal judge has now sentenced him to 10 years in prison. He will serve both his state and federal sentences, 10 years in total, in the state of Oregon. And that's it. Now, let me go to a naysayer. Roger, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. You're going to bring up the subject that is actually the subject of our Twitter poll today, and that is, should schools lock up their sports fields so the public cannot use them outside of school hours? You're a naysayer on that. Welcome to the program. What do you want to say?
Yeah, Lars, I agree with you most of the time on things. I just happen to work for a local school district in Multnomah County, and unfortunately, like other things, a few bad apples make it bad for everybody, and they ruin it for everything. So what happens is, when the school grounds are unlocked, people come out and spin cookies on the fields with their 4x4s and vandalize and leave all kinds of garbage and dog poop behind. So we can post signs saying, please pick up your dog poop, and we do, and we welcome people to walk their dogs during non-school hours. But unfortunately, we have people ignore that. They walk during school hours, dogs off leash. You ask them to leave nicely, and they get hostile. So unfortunately, where we used to have them more open, we've gotten to the point where we need to keep them more closed, and that's also for the safety of the students during school hours, of course, because...
Yeah, but we're not talking about during school hours, because this is specifically a school district, Hosford, that's saying we're locking the public out when the kids are not there. Your answer is that because... What? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, okay, so I understand part of what you're saying. So during the off school hour, same thing. All kinds of garbage on the left on the playground.
Well, but hold on, Roger. Do you think the same thing is true in every state park, that there are a few bad apples, in every national forest, in every state forest, in every federal forest, in every piece of public land? So if the answer is, rather than enforcing the rules on the people who act badly, so you punish the other 99.5% of the public by locking them all off of land that they own?
Well, I tend to want to agree with you on that. However, there are processes. People can call and get permission to use the sports fields for leagues or private events or whatever.
Well, no, no, I'm talking about individuals. Roger, if you just call and say, I want to walk my dog, this is in my neighborhood, I behave well, you're going to punish that citizen and say, no, out of 1,000 people, we've got one or two people who drop garbage, spin cookies, don't pick up their dog poop. I pick up my dog poop out of my yard. So why would you punish the other 99% and think that's acceptable to tell the public you own this, you maintain it, you spend a lot of money to make it look nice, you spent the money that we put up the fence and the locks with, and we're locking you out? Is that reasonable?
I can understand your point, Lars. Again, it comes down to when you and I were young, for sure when I was young, people's neighbor dogs ran all over the neighborhood, and everybody loved everybody's dogs, and everybody knew everybody's dogs, but unfortunately, we have to have leash laws to take care of that.
Except that my yard doesn't belong to my neighbor, but it also doesn't belong to the public. When you have public property, isn't there an obligation to keep it open to the public?
You got a valid point, definitely. I'm not sure I'm going to change my mind on that, though.
Because when school districts start to treat our property as their property and their little kingdom, the rest of us can say, then pound sand on the next school levy. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your calls. And, of course, it is the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And you're welcome to join in at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go first at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Well, no big surprise today. The State Court of Appeals has unanimously upheld Seattle's employer compensation tax. It's not, I guess, what you call an income tax, but I guess that depends on how you define that. Jason Mercier joins me now, director of the Center for Government Reform at the Washington Policy Center. Jason, good to have you back.
It's great to be on with you, Lars. And yeah, we need to give Seattle a golf clap. They have figured out a way to pass a legal, although incredibly economically distorting, tax.
And it is, look, by anybody's definition, this is an income tax on Washingtonians who live in Seattle, isn't it?
Well, it's a little complicated, and this is how Seattle threaded the legal needle. Because, you know, an income tax, and we're generally thinking about, you are taking money out of my paycheck. It's a tax on me, the individual, and the employee. And that's clearly what Seattle couldn't do. They tried to do that a few years ago, and it was ruled unconstitutional. So this was their second bite at the apple, and they got it right legally, although not even the former mayor would sign it because she knew it causes a lot of economic problems because the tax is easily avoided, just not by working in Seattle. But what Seattle ended up doing is saying, okay, we're not going to tax your paycheck, the employee. Instead, we're going to tax your employer for how much they pay you. Now, technically, that means you're going to get the same amount of money that you got before. But as that eats into your employer's profit margin, that may mean you may not get as large of pay raises. You may not get additional benefits. It could impact you in indirect ways. But it's a tax on the employer for paying their employees.
Well, and Jason, some of this gets down to what do they call a distinction without a difference? Because, you know, Oregon passed this stupid corporate activity tax. And I have people, you know, emailing me saying, hey, what is this? I got charged this. Well, because a lot of the companies have been saying, we're paying this much in taxes on. So you go buy a front end loader for $50,000 from an equipment company, and there's a CAT tax on it. And it's a couple of hundred bucks. And you say, I thought sales taxes were wrong. Well, technically, it's not a sales tax. It's a tax on the corporate activity of the corporation that just sold you the piece of equipment. Well, to the average person, is there any difference between a sales tax that's based on the value of what you bought or a tax on the corporation that's selling you the thing you're buying, which works out the same? The customer ends up paying the bill either way. In this case, my employees know that every time the state reaches into my pocket and takes $10, that's $10 I don't have to pay in salaries to my employees. So what the heck's the real difference at the end of the day between an income tax on the employee directly or a tax on me, the employer, which comes out of the same pot of money their paychecks come out of?
Yeah, and this gets into the technical incidence of the tax and the liability. But that exact point you were making came up in the arguments before the Court of Appeals. And in actually kind of defending what Seattle did, one of the justices, or judges rather, made that point, saying, you know, obviously this is not a direct tax on the employee, and that's why it's not an income tax. But they acknowledge that there could be the indirect cost that as the employer has to now pay this new tax, just to the point you were making, that's money not available for other things, including potential pay raises and compensation or hiring more workers that would have existed beforehand. Right? Somebody has to, that tax is going to have to come out of someplace because the business still has to be profitable to continue to keep its doors open. And this is, again, why, even though it passed the Seattle City Council, the former Seattle mayor didn't sign it. And she actually would have vetoed it if they hadn't had a veto-proof majority, because she knew, especially in the post-COVID era, where a lot of people are working remotely, you could cost jobs in Seattle. Because it's not every employer in Seattle has to pay this. They only have to pay it for their employees in Seattle. So not only do you have this new tax liability, but it's an administrative burden. And now I have to, if I'm an employer that's going to be subject to this tax and I have employees in multiple cities and employees that come and go out of Seattle, I have to track how much time they actually spend in Seattle to see how much tax I owe. So now you have that new administrative burden also on businesses.
Yeah, and by the way, Jason, a couple of years ago, Amazon said it was going to build 24 big high-rises in Seattle. And then they came under attack, you know, from the tax attempts of the city of Seattle, and they said, okay, we've got 14 done. We're going to quit at 14, I think was the number. So 10 big buildings didn't get built. Well, I'm not saying these kinds of things are the only reason that Amazon makes those decisions or any other company like Boeing. If Boeing says we're going to put up a new design center, gee, if we put all those engineers just outside the city, Seattle city limits, we don't incur this tax on all those engineering salaries, which are pretty healthy salaries. But if we put it inside the boundaries of Seattle, then we have to pay it. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to say we're going to go to, as what the Judge Learned Hand said, every man or company can arrange his affairs so as to pay the lowest possible tax. And it's not a patriotic duty to pay taxes except the ones you actually owe.
Yeah, every time Seattle cooks up a new tax or a tax increase, and I'm going to come back to that tax increase in a moment because there's some budget issues in Seattle. But I sometimes wonder if this is not a secret effort from the Bellevue Chamber of Commerce to increase economic activity in Bellevue, right? But, you know, so now that Seattle has been given this green light, it is legal. And, whether or not you like the tax, I do think they got the decision right, because there is a fine line between taxing the employer versus directly taxing the employee. In no way do I want to say this is a smart or prudent thing to do, trying to, you want to have high-paying jobs. You want to be able to have your employee base growing in their purchasing power. So to penalize an employer for paying good wages just seems like a very short-sighted economic policy. But that being aside, Seattle spent the money assumed from this tax and also spent a lot of the federal relief funds, which were one-time funds, on ongoing programs. So lo and behold, the news out of Seattle the end of last week, they have got a budget problem. And of course, their solution is, well, not let's not realign our spending. Let's not bring our spending back in line with our ongoing revenue. The solution so far from their budget chairs, who just so happened to be the sponsor of this employer compensation tax, is that, well, obviously, we need new progressive tax sources. We need to figure out new ways to have taxes based upon graduated income. Well, knowing that you can't do an income tax, what that indicates to me is they're probably going to be increasing this new tax they've just been given the green light on.
You know, that this is just, and by the way, I'd point out, Seattle has tripled its spending on the homeless. Portland and Multnomah County have done much the same. And they had all that cash, their new jumpstart tax, $200 million, 200+ million, $120-some million from the feds. And so they spent like drunken sailors or 20-year-olds or something, you know, with a brand new credit card. And now they're saying, wow, we overspent for 2 years, and now we're $117 million short for next year. They act like idiots most of the time, and they want more taxes. That's Jason Mercier, who's director of the Center for Government Reform at the Washington Policy Center. When we come back, who really stops the bad guys with guns? Well, it doesn't seem to be the cops, at least in Uvalde and other places like that. And I'll get to your phone calls and emails as well. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. One of the stories out of Uvalde, Texas, that I just tore at my heartstrings. That's been almost a month ago that 19 school children were murdered and two teachers lost their lives as well. And during some of the hearings that the state of Texas has been holding to try to find out who exactly screwed up and how badly and who should take the blame for this and how should they change things going into the future, I don't think they could have screwed up worse if they'd been working hard to do it. Because at Uvalde, Texas, we had police who stood by while people were dying. And ordinarily, I get calls from people who say, you back the cops far too often. I said, only back them when the facts are on their side, when the law is on their side. If they break the law, if they break their training, if they break the rules of engagement, then I'm not on their side. And in Uvalde, Texas, they violated everything. I mean, all of the lessons learned 20 years ago at Columbine. After that school shooting and people were outraged, they said, how could the cops stand by outside for a long period of time? I think it was at least 45 minutes. It may have been longer than that, but it was 20 years ago. And after that, police, I couldn't count the number of times that police officers had told me, anytime we have an active shooter, you go immediately to the person who is the active shooter or shooters, and you extinguish that threat. You end that threat. It may be by killing the guy or gal. It may be by taking them into custody. Whatever you have to do, you do that. And in Uvalde, they violated that. But the story that really tugged at me was the testimony that was given before a legislative committee in Texas, in which we found out one of the women who died was an elementary school teacher at the Uvalde school at Robb Elementary. And she had been shot. She got her cell phone out. She dialed up her husband and she said, I've been shot. I know that I'm dying. Please help. Her husband, who was an off-duty cop, got his gun, ran to the school, wanted to get inside, wanted to save lives, wanted to do exactly the things that you should be doing, which is go to the threat and neutralize the threat. I know they don't usually use words like extinguish or terminate, but I would. And what happened was, at the school, this police officer with a gun, willing to go in and put his life on the line to save not just his wife, but anybody else he could save. That's what good cops do. Was stopped, he was detained, he was disarmed, and he was escorted away. A good guy with a gun who showed up in Uvalde, Texas, and the testimony that came this week said that he was stopped. The other cops stopped him. The cops who were being told by their command, we're going to wait. We're going to wait for a set of keys to a door that wasn't locked. And nobody knew it wasn't locked because nobody bothered to try the door. They said, we have to have a key for that door. We have to have a master key. We're waiting for that. And they gave excuses like we're waiting for equipment. It turns out now the equipment was all on scene. We have to be able to get through this door. They had the tools to do that even without a key, even if it had been locked, but it wasn't locked. I thought I'd remind you of something, and that is, and I tell people this all the time, a good guy or a good gal with a gun stops crimes from happening about 1 million times a year, if not much more than that, but 1 million is the safe number. 1 million times a year. Think about that. And almost all of those people are not cops. They're not trained in any to any special degree. They simply have a gun and they stop the bad guys. Now, I'll cite a source because it's a lot safer to cite the left in this case. The New York Times actually looked hard at this and they said, who actually stops a bad guy with a gun? And I want to share the numbers with you. By the way, that 1 million number comes from the best study ever done of what the DOJ, the Department of Justice, calls defensive gun uses, DGUs. Fancy term for somebody's about to rob you, somebody's about to rape you, somebody's about to murder you. You pull out a gun, you point it at the bad guy, and in almost all cases, you don't even fire a shot. What does the bad guy do? What most bad guys would do, they turn on their heels and they run. So here are the numbers broken down by none other than the old gray lady, the New York Times. So they looked at 433 active shooting attacks and how they ended. 249 of the attacks ended before the police arrived. So out of 433 active shooting attacks, more than half, well over half of them, ended before the police arrived. Now, in 185 of those cases, the attacker either left the scene or died by suicide. That's about 185. In 64 of the cases, a bystander either subdued the attacker or shot the attacker. And the bystander was, in most cases, not a cop, not a security guard, but just a plain, ordinary, garden variety citizen. And in 184 of the cases, the attacks ended after the police arrived. In about two-thirds of those, the police either shot the attacker, subdued the attacker, or the attacker died of suicide. In 53 of them, the attacker died of suicide or surrendered. So the majority of the cases ended not by the action of the police, but by the action of a citizen. And in many of those cases, it was a citizen who took action and stopped the bad guy from doing what he was doing. And I think that's very, very telling. Because the number of active shooters, attacks, and it depends on how you count them and how you define them, has gone up somewhat. In 2011, it was about 13. 2012, about 21. Today, 2021, it was 61 of them. But again, sometimes the active shooter cases, well, when I say it's definitional, here's what I mean by that. You will get reports of an active shooter at a school. Well, they define as at a school as within a few blocks of the school. And what you have is gangbanger activity two blocks down the street from the school. So they say that they'll call that a school shooting. But the fact is, police officers shoot or physically subdue the shooter in less than one-third of all the attacks. Many times it is stopped by a citizen. Many times it is stopped by a citizen with a gun. And I think you should keep that in mind as you hear about schools that are trying to disarm, to get rid of the school resource officer, to ban the carry of concealed weapons on campus. I can tell you this, Uvalde, Texas was not one of the cities in Texas where they allow staff members at schools to be armed, only the school resource officers. But in many of the schools in Texas, Missouri, a number of other states, staff members at the school are not only armed, but the school puts up warning signs saying, some of our staff members are armed. It's designed to deter anybody from even thinking about going into that school and meaning to hurt people because it does deter people. Now, can you measure how many times something doesn't happen? No, you can't. But when you look at those numbers, 249 attacks ended before the cops even arrived. In about a quarter of the attacks, a bystander either subdued the attacker or in many cases, 22 of the cases, about 10% of them, shot the attacker. And in the majority of those cases, it was not a cop who did it. It wasn't a security guard, off duty or on duty. It was, in fact, a citizen. And that might just suggest to you where we ought to be going with this whole discussion about school security that has been launched one more time because of the 19 children and two teachers who were murdered on that day. Back in just a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, one of the issues we've been following on this show for quite some time, for years, literally, I don't think we can say a decade just yet, because it's really a relatively recent phenomena, and that is the phenomena of male athletes competing as women against women, and in many cases, beating them so soundly that the women who compete in that sport will never be able to match those numbers. I think it's safe to say that. Well, now there's been some action by the world body, FINA, that actually regulates swimming. And I think this is the right thing for them to do, to say we're not any longer going to allow those people who've passed through puberty as males and then identify as women compete against biological women. I think that's a sensible thing to do. Terry Schilling joins me now, who's president of the American Principles Project. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thanks again for having me.
Is this a good way, what FINA has decided to do, say, if you transition to female before age 12, and that has to be a relatively small number of people, I don't even think 12-year-olds can make, or 10-year-olds can make decisions like that, but so be it. There may be some people who say they did that. Is that a good place to draw the line? Or should we go to the, you know, the ultimate drawing of the line, saying if you're born a male, you can compete as a male, but you can't compete against women at all? Has FINA gone far enough?
Look, I think we have to be, I think we have to cherish and praise the good decisions and keep moving the ball forward towards the ideal, right? So this isn't ideal, but it's much better than what the status quo is, which is allowing males to compete against women as long as they suppress their quote unquote testosterone levels to a certain degree. Now, the arguments against this are essentially that this could lead to an increase of parents transitioning their children. I don't buy that, Lars. And frankly, I don't buy it because the arguments for transitioning kids that are brought to parents are essentially that your kid's going to kill themselves if they don't get their sex change. And that is a much more powerful argument than allowing your kids to compete. So, look, we have to walk, talk, and chew bubblegum at the same time here. We have to ban boys from female athletics everywhere we can, and then we also have to be working to ban these gender transitions for minors. It's not impossible. It's a very winnable fight. The voters are behind us. The people are behind us. We just have to stand up and hold our politicians accountable.
See, that's the argument I made, Terry, because I'm not a medical expert and I'm not an expert in sports. I did swim in junior high in competition for a couple of years, but I wasn't anything to write home about. So be it. But I put myself in that spot and say, what if I had, as a kind of a mediocre, male swimmer, had said, okay, I identify as a woman. And many of these sanctioning bodies don't say, and you have to have, some do, some don't. Say you have to go through the transition, you have to be taking hormones. The problem is, when somebody says, I identify as a woman, most of the government policies in this country that are now recognizing that and officially sanctioning it in other parts of life, not necessarily athletics, they say, well, we're not going to make any requirements as to what you have to have done. Have you had surgery? Have you had the hormones? Or do you just identify as a woman? And when you make it that loose, you're going to have people who say, well, there's an advantage to changing over. Clearly, for Leah Thomas, the swimmer, to beat women by times that women, I think, biologically never will achieve, which is going to put an asterisk next to everything, and it's going to knock some legitimate biological women out of competition altogether.
No, that's exactly right. And you're hitting on something. It's basically been the wild, wild west when it comes to sports and other areas in this country regarding gender. There have been no rules. There have been really no real regulations. And you have to praise FINA for doing the right thing here and actually setting some rules that make some bit of sense. Now, the interesting thing here, Lars, is that this effort to, regulate the, transgender participation in women's sports, it's being driven by, third world countries. Right, non-Western nations, and FINA basically had to throw the Western countries a bone because they've gone absolutely crazy, and that's the only reason why there's this stipulation. Whereas if you start to transition before puberty, then you can compete. But it's just amazing how a lot of these non-Western nations are actually the only ones that are sane left in this world.
Well, and Terry, when it comes to American principles, This country, over a number of decades, has evolved a whole set of rules that essentially say until you're 18, you can't make any serious decisions. You can't sign a contract. You can't get a piercing. You can't get a tattoo. You can't go to a tanning parlor. You can't smoke cigarettes. You can't drink alcohol. I mean, there's a whole list of things you can't do. And then all of a sudden, the pro-LGBTQ++ and all the other letters they're going to add on to it have said, no, but when you're seven, you can decide you're a girl when you were born a boy. And you say, hold on, you're not mature enough to go to a tanning parlor until you're 18 or something, but you can decide you're a girl instead of a boy. Does that fit into anything else that we as American society have been doing?
No, it doesn't fit in. And it's totally contrary to not just being an American, but to being decent, right? Children don't have fully developed brains. They literally can't fathom the idea of sterilizing themselves, of giving up their ability to have children in 10 to 20 years. And that's what's so egregious. You know, Lars, I don't know if you saw this, but Bill Maher on HBO said, you know, if we allowed seven-year-olds when I was growing up to determine, you know, make these lifelong decisions about what they'd be when they grow up, the world would be full of cowboys and princesses. He said something like, you know, I wanted to be a pirate, and I'm so glad that my parents didn't take me in to have my eye removed and for peg leg surgery. You know, and that's what we're dealing with here, right? Like, these are little kids, and some of them are being coerced. Some of them are being groomed into it, and others are just flat out confused and are actually suffering from just dysphoria.
Terry, I've got another 30. I've got a six-year-old granddaughter, and she does want to be a ballerina, and she does want to do, and she wants to be a talk show host some days too. But, you know, and that's okay. That's a nice compliment. But one of the things I wonder, how much of this is about kids? Do you think a lot of kids love attention? And some of them find it through positive ways. You know, they do things, and when they find out that the audience, their parents, grandparents, and everybody else applaud when they do it, then they do more of that. And some of them decide it's bad behavior that gets attention. And all of a sudden, they decide I'm going to be bad a lot because every time I'm bad, they pay a lot of attention to me. And as you get older and you mature, you say, okay, I'm not going to do the attention-seeking stuff. Some of them don't stop until after they're out of college. But how much of this is because you say, I feel uncomfortable, I'm going through puberty, things don't seem right. And I've noticed that if you're LGBTQ, if you're part of that crowd, you get a lot of very favorable attention. And nobody's allowed to say anything adverse about what you're doing. I think I'll do that. And maybe consciously or unconsciously, it's attention-seeking behavior that it sounds like, based on the most recent studies, an awful lot of the kids you're afraid of committing suicide if you don't let them transition, do transition, and the latest numbers say, and commit suicide in sadly too many cases. It's like parents buy into this nonsense, and then their child takes his or her own life, which is especially tragic because it seems like the parents have contributed to that.
Well, firstly, I will say that it's all lies. Transgenderism and the surgeries and the hormone treatments, those are actually a step closer to suicide, not away from it. And what do I mean by that? Suicide is the rejection of your body and your soul. And what transgenderism is it's a rejection of your body, right? You have to alter your body, your hormonal makeup, and it's a rejection. So you're actually taking a step closer to suicide, not further away from it. So that's a total lie. Regarding whether or not this is about attention, I think it's important to realize that all these cases are all unique. But I will tell you, one of the first stories that I read was a testimony of a mother whose son was beginning to say that he was a woman or a girl. And what had happened is they got the boy into counseling, and they found out through talking to him that the boy was identifying as a girl because the mom and dad had just had twin girls, and they were giving all the attention to the baby girls.
That makes sense. Terry Schilling is the president of the American Principles Project. Terry, thanks a lot. We'll have a longer conversation another day. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Call 811. Do it before you dig, whether it's in your yard or in the field. Call 811. It is the law. It's also a great idea and a great way to avoid sticking a shovel or an excavator blade into the middle of an electric line or maybe a gas pipeline. Go to digsafelyoregon.com or the Washington State equivalent. Our Twitter poll today, should public schools lock up their sports fields so that the public can't use them? When I wrote that question, I thought it actually kind of answers itself. If they're public fields, you don't lock the public out of them. But we now have school districts that are beginning, in particular, that are acting like little kingdoms where they say, why, the taxpayers bought us this land, and they pay for the fertilizer and the grass seed and all the maintenance that goes into keeping it beautiful, and the taxpayers are going to pay for the big wire fence that we put around the public's land, and then we're going to put locks on the fence so the public cannot use the public's own fields outside of school hours. It makes no sense to me. Now, if they have a problem with the so-called homeless, drug addicted, who are bringing hypodermic needles to school grounds, then deal with the bad guys, but don't punish the law-abiding because you're trying to aim your punishment at those people who don't obey the laws at all. Should public schools lock up their sports fields? No. And today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Yesterday's Twitter poll, if the government, and this is Joe Biden's latest deal, if government orders cigarette makers to cut nicotine in cigarettes to almost nothing, will it help you quit? I said no. So did 70% of you. But 30% of you, a sizable number of you, said yes, it would help you quit. Let's go to Mike in Bellevue, listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, this gun bill with the expanded juvenile record, including in the background check, it's not going to work. The little darlings, or the school officials, will want to protect the little darlings, and they'll use restorative justice. They won't record any offenses, just like the shooter in Portland and this Uvalde shooter. He tortured cats.
He walked around with a plastic bag full of dead cats at times, and apparently they knew it. If those weren't warning signs,
they're going to cover up all the violations. And
I think you're right.
You'll see more 18-year-olds buying guns who should have been prosecuted, weren't prosecuted, were patted on the head and told to sin no more, and then they will go out and buy guns and shoot people up.
I think you're right, Mike. And in fact, it'd be interesting to know what the schools in Bellevue, where you live, what they've been doing, because for about the last decade, here's the equation that's been laid out in front of citizens, and the school boards will admit to it. They'll say, we want to stop, we want all the school resource officers out of the schools. Well, why do they want that? They say because when the resource officer...
I think Bellevue took all the resource officers out.
And you know why, Mike? Because they said, but when kids commit crimes on school grounds, we don't want them treated as crimes. And you say, well, hold on. You know, one of your kids attacks another one. Don't you want them arrested and charged with assault? No, because we don't want, number one, is their objection is they don't want the child, they think of it, a 16, 17, nearly 18-year-old child to be charged with a crime. But the second reason is that when they enforce the rules and they suspended kids, expelled kids, or had kids arrested, too many of them turned out to be children of color. They were black or Hispanic, primarily, not white or Asian. And they said, well, that number is really embarrassing to school administrators when they say, why is it if Bellevue is, 5% black, that the number of kids being arrested at your schools is 10 or 15 or 20%? And, Mike, I'll tell you, the city of Seattle is not blameless either. Several years ago, way before the pandemic, the city of Seattle, after legalization of pot, they said, we want to stop writing tickets for smoking pot in public, which even with legalization, it's not legal to smoke pot in public. And you say, well, why do you want to stop writing the tickets? And they said, because over 30% of the tickets we write are to black residents of Seattle who are smoking pot in public. And he said, so if they're smoking pot in public, write them a ticket. And they said, oh, no, that's inconvenient because 30% of Seattle's population is not black. So therefore, people would say, you see, you're being racist. No, they weren't being racist. They were writing tickets to the people who were caught committing the offense. But the city of Seattle said our solution is not to convince people to follow the law. Our solution is just stop writing the tickets altogether. And you say, well, hold on, does that make sense?
That the culture, white culture and black culture, is exactly the same, and that black and white people treat marijuana or school exactly the same.
One comment I had is the
money for hardening the schools. It's going to be diverted to buy espresso machines or go into teacher salaries.
Probably so. And Mike, how hard, if the
legislature gave the schools extra money for the McCleary decision, and all that money got diverted into teacher salaries.
It did. And here's the key question, Mike. If citizens said, we want public education, the Constitution requires in Washington State that it be adequately funded. They made the case it wasn't. When they adequately funded it under McCleary, they said, now we're going to end up with kids who are smarter, that they learn better, that they'll actually learn their lessons. And guess what? They poured in billions of dollars, and the education system didn't get any better. The taxpayers didn't get anything for their money. Mike, thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show.